Okay, we're recording now. Oh, I just want to say how much I loved your book.
Oh, thank you. Good.
Yeah, I just thought it's such a contrast between going back 60,000 years and yet talking about lamingtons and how to make string. So it's this incredible, incredible range of things. And I've got my ideas about why you put all that in, but maybe you'd like to say what your intention was.
Well, there are many ways to discover what the past is. The most obvious ones, looking at archaeological records, reading diaries, reading letters, etc. But also the foods that people not just eat, but have as iconic foods, tell a lot about your history. And for me, the lamington is one of them. Now, the lamington is quintessentially Australian. It originated here, it became phenomenally popular here, and for many decades it was one of the great standard luxury foods. So why the lamington? And if you look at a lamington, first of all, it means that we were a wealthy enough country where people could afford treats. Reading any of the social histories, the letters, the memoirs back there, even in the Depression, people would try to have a treat on Saturdays or Sundays, whether it was a scone or a fruit damp or what have you. We were also one that was not wealthy enough and egalitarian enough to have a lot of social occasions where you bring a plate, where you bring a plate. And lamington, of course, was perfect for this. If you try to take a cake long distances, either on bumpy roads or on a cart or a horse, all of which I've tried to do, you often find out that the cake splits in half. But a lamington has got extraordinary structural integrity. It's small, but it's bound together by that firm layer of icing and coconut. It means that we are a hot nation, and it was a nation before refrigeration and Tupperware. So that, again, you can take butter cake and you can keep it fresh, even in very, very hot weather, even in conditions where if you make scones, 10 minutes later you can use them as cricket balls, which I've also seen being done. They're so hard. But not a lamington. A lamington in its icing and its coconut stays fresh. It also means that we're an informal nation. Rather than, or say, the classic Victoria sponge, which you really do need to eat with a cake fork if you're not going to get cream down your front and jam on your fingers. A lamington can be eaten with your fingers because, again, that coating of icing means you can pick it up after supper or at a tennis party or after church. You can pick it up and you don't have to lick your fingers in a rude way afterwards. I could keep going about the social significance of the lamington.
Well, I was also very fascinated by the way that one of the themes of the book that came out for me was the way that white settlers brought a whole lot of things with them, but also their mindset. And they couldn't actually see what was here, and they especially couldn't see the food that was around them. It was just totally invisible.
Yes, or if not invisible, it could also be toxic. Partly it was invisible. They just simply didn't notice. Partly they learnt very early. And if you read some of the things that Governor Phillip and Surgeon White did, the number of times they got incredibly bad indigestion and diarrhea and all sorts of other things from eating native fruits and vegetables, it was fairly obvious that these were... They realised quite quickly that a bright red berry in Australia may cause you some severe symptoms indeed, particularly if you eat too much of it. But also, we were settled at a time when people were very conservative about food. Reading Dickens, for example, where an affluent middle-class person would even be incredibly suspicious of the casseroles that they would serve in France. People were very, very nationalistic and conservative about their food. And, for example, the whales. Now, whale meat, I'm told, I haven't eaten it, is actually quite delicious and can be served most wonderful sushi, it makes the most wonderful steaks, and there were a lot of whales around Australia, not just to be caught, but to be washed up on beaches. But gentlemen did not eat whale. Even in World War II in England, when the British were starving, there had to be this massive publication PR campaign to get people to eat whale. They called it snook, just to try to get people to eat the protein from a whale. There's one account of a whale being washed up at Manly and the indigenous people gathering for a feast. But again, even in that incredibly hungry, meat-hungry colony, amongst the plenty, I mean, one whale feeds a heck of a lot of people, they didn't take any of the meat away with them, even though the indigenous people were more than willing to share it.
And that's what's fascinating in your book as well, is talking about, well, it explodes a lot of myths, and one of them was that the early colony in Sydney was starving, but actually they were homesick and miserable and putting up a protest.
They were. The myth of starvation began even with those first getters back, when the ships that brought the first fleet went back to England. They had enough food, well, they thought for 3 years. It turned out because of rats that they were running short after about 2 years. But they had plenty of food. At that stage, there was plenty of fish, plenty of grazing for the animals. But Major Ross still sent letters back talking about how everyone was going to starve here. He was a troublemaker, and to put no fine point on it, he lied. Very deliberately, he hated where he was, he hated the job, he hated Philip. He was a bitter, deeply resentful and extremely untruthful, mind-cheating man. So it began then. But even with, if you read Watson Tench, they talk about the fear of starvation, or even starvation was rapidly approaching. But there is no indication that it was ever there. Certainly in the months before the Juliana came, they were very worried about winter. Tench was writing those words when there was plenty of food. It was midsummer, there were masses of fish, the gardens were producing extraordinarily well. They were cutting the rations, but the reasons that Philip cut the working hours was to encourage the convicts to work their own gardens, which in fact very few did. But it wasn't because they needed extra food then. They had plenty of food then. They were very worried, however, about winter. And look, with reason as well. These were people who were used to English winters. Even though they'd spent a couple of winters in Australia, they still weren't used to the idea that, in the Sydney climate anyway, vegetables keep growing all through winter. In England, you either have to bring the harvest in, or there are a very, very few things you can leave in the ground over winter and dig up. They really were scared that they were going to starve with winter coming, at all of the hardships of an English winter. That's the lack of wood, all sorts of other things.
And also, it was fascinating, like, a lot of the male convicts, they didn't know how to cook because in London you didn't have to. You bought takeaway if you were poor.
Yes, we also forget too that until recently, a heck of a lot of men didn't cook when my brother got married. I probably shouldn't actually tell this story. My mother and I arrived the first day that he and his wife were in their new house, having come back from their honeymoon. And my brother was looking at an egg that they'd bought and saying, oh, no, look, I don't bother, I don't want the hard-boiled egg, I'll just have it soft. He assumed that eggs came soft-boiled, just heated them up. Recently, most men in our culture did not cook.
Yes.
Even my husband, being a man from that era, he doesn't know how long you would boil asparagus for. Every time he has to ask me, or if I ask him to cook the broccoli because I'm finishing something, again, he will keep popping in to actually ask, oh, should I turn it off now? Socially, we've changed so much that, again, it is so hard for historians to actually realise what it was like in the past, what it was like to give without electric light, what it was like to give on a ship about the size of a small hall, and why you need to drive animals on it, the darkness of Eureka. These are things that are now so alien to us.
Well, that's why your book is so beautiful, because there's just this exquisite detail about, for example, the personalities of Joseph Banks and Captain Cook, and you just think, gosh, fancy being stuck on a boat together. But also the importance of the live animals, and maybe you'd like to say about why Australia hadn't ever really been colonised before.
Yes, it's one of the great myths that we learned at school, that Captain Cook discovered Australia. In fact, most of Australia had already been mapped before Cook was sent to look for the Great South Land, which wasn't Australia. It was this mythical land of gold and riches that was supposed to be somewhere in the Pacific. He had specific orders to go home via the south of Australia, where Tasman had already mapped. But the ship had been badly damaged in the southern storms and storms in New Zealand. So he didn't think they would be able to follow orders. The most sensible course then would have been to follow Tasman's route up to Batavia, the Dutch port of the Spice Islands. But he didn't. Against all orders, he went up the east coast simply because parts of it hadn't been mapped. But he knew from a map in his possession that the Great Barrier Reef was there and it was dangerous. It was called dangerous waters. Now, back then, ships needed large numbers of live animals on board for fresh food, because in the days before refrigeration, that was the only way of doing it. And that's why, if you read the logbooks and diaries of the time, over and over, went ashore, cut grass, dried grass, take grass ashore, cut grass. Western Australia, because of the trade winds, the easiest way to get to Batavia, which was really the source of the spice trade and the wealth, the great fortunes of the world were made by trading with the Spice Islands and Batavia. You took the trade winds, these really fast winds across to WA. You went up the coast of WA and then to Batavia. It would have made so much sense to have a supply port in WA so you could get to Batavia. But Australia is an old country. The few great harbours and rivers we've got are almost hidden in these bays with very, very narrow entrances. Even Cook missed Sydney Harbour, he missed Moreton Bay, but the other ships missed the wonderful harbour at Albany. So in a sailing ship, you needed safe harbour and they couldn't find it, but you needed grass. And until white settlers brought their sheep and cattle, which ate the perennial ground covers, most Australian ground covers were perennial, and they weren't grass. They weren't easily cut for hay, and while wallabies can survive on them extremely nicely, thank you very much, often they were toxic to sheep and cattle. So we didn't have the harbours, we didn't have the easily accessible fresh water, and most of all, we didn't have the grass. But if it hadn't been for that goat on the Endeavour, when the Endeavour was wrecked, and Cook, far from being this cautious man who'd been taught at school, he really took the most extraordinary risk, going against all his orders, to actually go up that coast. When the Endeavour was wrecked, as a reasonable assumption that there was a pretty good chance it was going to be wrecked, a young man, Jonathan Monkhouse, got them to wrap the hull in a sail, pack it with dried manure. As the dry manure sucked up water, it sealed the sail against the hull and they were able to limp the shore and repair the ship. If there hadn't been those live animals, the Endeavour would never have got home, and Joseph Banks' report would never have convinced the British government to send a colony on an almost 9-month journey to the ends of the world. And for Joseph Banks too, his absolute twit, apparently at Kew Gardens, they can still see the samples that he collected, the other botanists carefully collecting and pressing their samples. He just grabbed handfuls of things and stuffed them into a bag. He reported back that Botany Bay, where they had stopped, was this wonderful safe harbour. It wasn't the first fleet was nearly wrecked when they tried to get out of it. It's not shelter from the Sutherlands. He reported straight timber, perfect for masts and building, and by no stretch of the imagination, even a wet year can it be like that. He reported good deep soil, and again, anyone who's been to Botany Bay knows it's sandy and not deep, good soil, lush grass. Now, there may have been some lush tussocks there if it had been a wet season, but again, even in a wet season, you just don't get that at Botany Bay. He completely misunderstood everything he had seen, and because of that, the British government sent a colony just on the word of a wealthy, influential, titled man who was an enthusiastic but amateur botanist and a complete, absolute twit. They sent this small, nearly 2,000 people around the world to a place he had only seen for a few days, decades before. And they were very nearly never heard from again. As I said, the fleet was nearly wrecked in Botany Bay. By then, the convicts were starving and had scurvy, and the animals were nearly starving. They'd run out of fodder. They were so weak they couldn't stand. They really only had another few days to find somewhere where they could land and land safely. And it was really only a miracle that such a short way up the coast, between this narrow gap in the rocks that Cook had noted, they went through it, and there was one of the world's great harbours, which not only had got the grass, but had got tall, straight timber, it had got good fresh water from what became known as the Tank Stream. They had actually found the perfect place to have a colony.
And that was so...
only by accident.
Well, that's so beautiful as well, because you've really encapsulated it's people's characters, it's those stupid human decisions, and you never know how it's going to turn out. Oh, sorry, that's my dog going a bit nuts. But the other thing is also that England sent out this, these ships. And another theme of the book is how people want to extract profit from the land, whether it's having a colony there or sending, a base for ships or... for gold mines, and it's often how interesting how the theme of gold and endless riches and the never-ending bounty of the land is a theme.
Yes, it is, and again, time after time after time, you have exactly the same myths in Australian history. Australia was, discovered in inverted commas, with Indigenous people already here, discovered over and over again, because so many of the European nations, and possibly China, were convinced that there had to be a land of gold in the south. It was just one of these myths with absolutely no foundation whatsoever, but it was so attractive. They would send fleet after fleet after fleet, including Cook again, to find this land of gold with no evidence at all that it existed. The gold rushes, there'd been... gold discovered in Australia decades before the first gold rushes. What made the difference was that it rained. You need water to pan gold, and the creeks have been dry. And you also, of course, need rain for crops so that you can feed miners in a gold rush. If it hadn't been for the rainy seasons in the late 40s and in the 1850s, we would never have had a gold rush. But even then, it was an illusion. A few miners struck it rich. We have no records about how many starved, but anecdotally, just from the records of the gold field, hundreds if not thousands starved. Mm. You just simply could not make enough gold to buy food and to survive. It was absolutely grinding, horrendous poverty, and the reports of the inspectors on the gold fields reflect that. And that, of course, was one of the things that led to Eureka. This just incredible, incredible poverty. But it's still there today. We've got this concept that of endless land in Australia. where if you make a mess at one place, you can just leave it and move on to another place. There are no accurate figures for the number of abandoned mines in Australia that are deeply polluted, and in fact our entire gross national product is probably not enough to make them safe again.
Gosh.
We have just got all over Australia now, not just from mining, places polluted from industry and other factors, and we simply do not have the money. It's so much easier just to forget they exist, because the problem is really too big to correct.
And
we've got business that there is an endless amount of Australia to move on to. Okay, coal seam gas, it doesn't matter if you lose a few hundred acres or a few thousand acres of farmland, there's always plenty more. And at the beginning, there was some truth to that. You could leave it behind and go to another place. But that's no longer the case. We've still got the same mindset. But these days, most of the places where people want developments are places that are already being intensively used, either where people are living or the desperately needed agriculture in a world that is becoming, shortage of good farmland, shortage of good water, climate change, etc. We need to protect our farmland. We can't always assume there's just going to be more and more, and we can keep using up the land, leaving bits as desert or too polluted to be safely used.
And the other thing, well, I loved so many things about this book, but your obvious love and intimacy with your land, and, you know, have watching it over decades, and also the idea that you need to understand the land over many lifetimes, but also the threat that is being posed to you by having a gold mine just down the road. It really struck me how, oh, gosh, it really made me upset to think how much you love and understand the land, and yet this other land use down the road really has no understanding of what it's doing. And really, is it really profitable if it sweeps away all these beautiful, you know, highly adapted, really intricate networks of life?
I think the answer to that is we don't know, and that is what's distressing. One of the best examples is possibly the Gladstone Port. Now, all human activities have got an impact. I do accept that we do need, whether it's going to be with agriculture, whether it's going to be various industries, extractive industries, they are going to have an impact. But you need to look at a cost-benefit analysis of it. Is this going to be more benefit than cost? And one of the fascinating ones, as I said, is Gladstone. Gladstone, you've got this incredible risk to the Great Barrier Reef and its tourism. You've got this incredible risk to fishing. You've got breaches which have never been brought to book, even though possibly oars have been broken. But again, if you look at the cost-benefit analysis, by improving another 300 kilometres of road, we could keep the development but use the Port of Darwin instead, which is in fact closer to the north, would be more cost effective, wouldn't risk the Great Barrier Reef or the fishing industry. Darwin is far better geographically and ecologically to be a far more major port. But again, it's the mindset. It's also a mindset too, which is you either have no development or unchecked development. I'm very much arguing for let's look at the most effective and cost-effective development. But before you develop, you do a cost-benefit analysis. Are we going to gain more than we lose in the short term and the long term? If this development is going to be cost effective, then it is going to have to be able to pay the costs of what it does do. So that, okay, it may be better for society to have it, but if it is going to be that profitable, then it is also profitable enough to repair any of the damage and compensate for what it has done. But also to look at far more stringent baseline studies, and that is something we don't have. I've been lucky enough to be taught by people who, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of years of knowledge of the land where I live, so that you can look at what flowers and when, or what the lizards are doing, or what the turtles are doing, and have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen in the next 24 hours, or the next 2 or 3 years, or even the next 20 or 30 years. But ironically, these days, we've got more tools than ever before for looking at the weather now, and the weather over the past 20 and 30,000 years. We've got the scientific tools, and we've got the scientific expertise to do it. But increasingly, we're using it less, not more. Government after government are cutting back research programs. They're cutting back research programs to only ones which are going to make a profit in 3 to 5 years, not open-ended ones. Cutting back ones that they suspect might come up with conclusions that they don't want. We do have the ability to listen to the land these days, even if so much of the law of the land for the last 10,000 years has been lost. We still have got ways to study the land, study the land in our history, and study what is happening now and what might happen. But we're doing it less rather than more, even though we've got more tools to do it. But even on an individual scale, in my childhood, we were taught as a matter of course about how the very basics of living on this land. I was brought up in Queensland where the houses were on stilts because every time there would be a major storm or the tail end of a cyclone, there'd be a flood. And it didn't matter. We got a few days off school. We sat on the veranda and sort of wondered if there might be fish in the flood and enjoyed ourselves thoroughly. But the houses in that area now are being built out of brick close to the ground, or those on posts are having the bottoms infilled so that they get swept away by floods. They're not floodproof. It is possible to build floodproof houses. Australians were doing it for decades, and in the Netherlands now, they're coming up with wonderful designs for floodproof houses where they're on great big chains sunk deep into the ground. So when the flood comes, the houses and their walkway simply float. You can have a floodproof house. But year after year, floods and bushfire seem to take people by surprise. In your own area, if you dig a 30-centimetre hole and look for flood debris, if there is flood debris there, it means there has been a flood, and there will be again. Look at the native vegetation in your area. If there are shrubs that need fire to regenerate, then this is a land where there are often fires. And if there have been often fires in the past, then there will be fires again. But even here, there are such simple little things that you can follow. When the termite queen fly, there's going to be rain in 24 hours. When the snake-necked turtles head uphill, you know in 10 days there is going to be a big flood. They don't do it for little ones. They do it for big ones. When you see the golden skinks and the little fen skinks start getting aggressive, you know there's going to be a massive thunderstorm, probably hail. When they go absolutely incredibly aggressive and start tearing at each other, even the snakes, you know this is going to be such a bad storm that you have to get to shelter fast, tie down everything you can, put things over the bars of the windows. This is going to be very, very, very bad. The severity of the reptiles' response, there is a direct correlation to how bad the storm's going to be, and you know it's going to be within about an hour and a half or 2 hours before it happens. Sorry, I could keep going with this.
Well, I want to sort of pick up as well, because it is a really central thing about how the land has created Australians, and this land of extremes creates in some ways mateship and caring for one another, but also you've said such a lot of interesting things about Indigenous ways. And so in some ways it seems to be that this land in particular has encouraged collaboration and helping one another, but also the idea of personal restraint and to look out to make sure that you don't overload the land. So when the terrible things happen, which they will, and spectacularly so in Australia, whereas maybe it's not quite the same elsewhere, that you're ready for that. But also the idea that the Indigenous women, and maybe you could talk a bit about their working of the landscape.
So much has been said about plastic farming, but also a lot of Indigenous farming was simply invisible to the white settlers. The men understood the go hunt kangaroo thing. If you look at any colonial art gallery and look at the paintings then, there's usually somewhere, there's bloke with spear and dead kangaroo. They understood this. It was very, very close to the European experience. What they didn't see were the mobile farms of the Indigenous women. And partly this is because no female opinion was given much weight back then, white or black. But also the women would not have been comfortable talking about it to men or even to people who did not need to know and were not going to use it. Forestic farming was used, but it's now being used as an excuse for every pyromaniac or if any government official who wants to actually have a quick and cheap way of looking as though they're preparing for next season's bushfires. It's a lot cheaper and easier to burn a large piece of land without actually studying it closely to tell, is this going to really make the fire dangerous, or is it going to increase the number of species that burn extremely well and actually like fire? But in doing that, they often destroy or have destroyed the living gardens and the mobile farms of the Indigenous women. So much has been talked about forestic farming for lush grass for kangaroos, and yet hunting kangaroos in many areas was almost a spiritual activity rather than a food gathering activity. Many Indigenous men would have had a connection with the kangaroos, and in fact, if they killed it, would not have been allowed to eat it. Most of the food was hunted by the women in far less dramatic ways. I remember as a teenager being shown by a female of a man the two ways to catch a fish. And the one was a very, very funny way of a man actually just standing there motionless with his spear waiting for a fish. An incredibly macho over many, many hours. But the female way was you actually use one of your baskets, which has been knitted from stringy bark, put through a fire so it's waterproof. As the tide goes out, you get a stick, you put it in. As the tide goes out, the fish swim into it. They can't swim out of it. And you just actually sit on the sand and have a gossip, get the kids to get some driftwood for a fire, and then you eat the fish. The whole food gathering takes maybe about 45 seconds. It's not dramatic. It's not macro. No one's going to cheer, oh, wow, you're such a fantastic spearman. You've managed to catch spear a fish, which is not easy. But you get a heck of a lot more food and very, very quickly. Another woman was actually telling me about the problem with the men coming back from the kangaroo hunts is that the kids would be calling for their dinner long before the men got back again. So, of course, you'd have other food that everyone would eat. And then you'd eat the kangaroo and, cheer the blokes. I'll not say, oh, yes, great hunter, et cetera, et cetera. But you certainly didn't rely on them to provide dinner. It was more sort of a trophy of the hunt idea. It was not necessarily a major food source. And in large parts of Australia, the large parts of Australia where there was a bulk of population, certainly we've got kangaroos and things like the Western Plains, but a lot of the river valleys and the places where the bulk of Indigenous people lived in the East Coast and the South West and in Tasmania, wallabies are far more common than kangaroos. It's not kangaroo country. And wallabies do not taste good. their meat is actually quite rank. You'd go for other things. It looks dark possum. Food that actually tastes good, not wallaby. But one of the most striking things for me here was a visit by a group of Indigenous women. Now, it had been many generations since they had been able to come to this area. I'd walked it almost daily and been studying it for 40 years. Yet when they came here, they could tell me exactly where things would be, where the Kurrajong trees would be, because they would be signposts to actually say which ridge were easier to go up. We're looking at the highway of the clematis blossom, because that was where you sent the young women, because of course young women have got a lot more energy than us who are getting older, and they would go every spring following the planted highway of clematis blossom, that white highway. They'd follow the highway to their stringy bark trees to get the inner bark of the stringy bark exactly at the right time to make more baskets, fish traps, etc., etc., and to plant it. And they couldn't get lost because they were following the stringy bark way. Where we built our house, probably not quite by coincidence, is where people have camped for tens of thousands of years, as we discovered once we actually dug down through the sand. And I always thought it was just coincidence that the emu berries, the wombat berries, the sandpaper figs, happened to be bigger and sweeter around where we built our house. But of course they weren't. They had been carefully selected, they had been carefully planted, and they had been planted in the right place. So when one tree died, a seedling of the same species would take its place. Once you created these farms, they were there for millennia, and they still are. The bunya nuts here. Now, we're in a sheltered valley. You just don't get bunya nuts for about another 100 kilometres. They had to have been brought trigger-trigger and planted here as a food source. Again, this is something I could talk about for so much, but there are two great lessons we need to learn from the Indigenous care of the land. And one is prepare for the worst. Indigenous nations always kept various food supplies, population levels, etc., that were what the land could support in bad times, not in good times. And the second one is keep your water clean. That was one of the great duties of Indigenous women, and it's one of the great hearts of the law of Indigenous women. You always keep the water clean. You sweep away the droppings every morning and a whole range of other things. More than there would be pools you could swim in, there are other pools you never swim in, you do not wash things in, you don't put fish poisons in, because these are the drinking pools, these are the emergency pools. Above all else, you look after your water. And those two things are lessons that modern Australians desperately need to learn, all three. Learn your land, prepare for the worst, and keep your water clean.
And that's what I thought you really, it came across very strongly for me as an invitation from you to start looking, everyone to start looking around them differently and really notice what's there and to start letting the land teach us and really listening. And from that, we can grow and it's fantastic. So I'd like to thank you very much for writing this book. I've just got one comment in that you said genetic engineering for the public good, you know, might be fine. And on one level, I totally agree with you. But the trouble is that now universities are doing public-private partnerships with industry and everything. And so my thing is I'd much rather see, you know, a development of or more science into all these traditional ways of looking at things and how we bring that into the present. And
The point I was making really was that genetic engineering is not intrinsically bad, but it is not entirely, but almost entirely being used for bad things.
Yes.
Some genetic engineering, I think, is actually being used for good, but interestingly, that's very, very rarely being done funded, or certainly not by industry, and very, very rarely even by publicly funded bodies. It's usually being done so that someone can make a lot of money.
Yes.
And get rid of varieties which might be a lot hardier. They're making the world more dangerous, not less dangerous, but just occasionally. As I said, but I don't think the technology is necessarily intrinsically bad. It's a little bit like mining. Mining is not intrinsically bad. They were indigenous mines, some of them extremely deep. It is possible to mine with minimal impact and with enormous social benefit. It's not intrinsically bad. Farming, too, is not intrinsically bad. It just happens that 98% of it has caused ecological disaster.
Mm.
But it's not. But it doesn't have to be that way. It's like building a house. Most houses burn, but it doesn't have to be that way. We can build houses. Sadly, my house is not one of them, but when we're burned, it will be. We can build houses which will survive bushfires. A lot of my past 40 years has been spent showing that it is possible to grow commercial quantities of fruit and vegetables and still have wild animals occupying the same territory in possibly even greater numbers than they were before. It's possible. The fact that we don't do it doesn't mean it's impossible.
I think you're right. What you're saying, it's the mindset and the aims that we use.
Exactly. It's like surgery on human beings. A lot of surgery saves lives. A lot of other surgery, particularly orthopedic surgery on knees, probably makes things a lot worse.
Mm.
It's having a mindset where most people, I think, are not prepared to change their mind, and they've got an enormous capacity very carefully not look at any data which might force them to reevaluate their opinions. Humans don't like to change their mind.
Yes.
And that's really what the last sentence in that book is, that looking at the past shows you that things change. Looking at the past means that you are no longer so much a social or, for that matter, ecological conservative. You have to see that things change. And so that final thing was, final prediction, tomorrow will probably be pretty much like today, but one day it won't be. And that is what understanding history will give us. The deep emotional understanding that one day tomorrow is going to be different. But as a really adaptable human species, if we change our mindset, we can cope with it.
Well, I think I'll leave it there. Thank you so much for talking with me. That was just wonderful. And good luck with your book.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. Goodbye.